is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation. Rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in for Steve Gruber today. Thanks for joining us on the program. Appreciate it. Well, public dollars could go to educate special education students in private schools under a constitutional amendment proposal that moved out of a state House education committee last week. The proposals moved on a party line vote, which would be enough to get it through committee. But in order to get it to move through the state House, it would take 109 or 73 of the 109 members to get it through the House. And then you would need a supermajority over in the Senate to put it on the ballot. It is HJRB. It is sponsored by Representative Tim Kelly from Saginaw. It would allow the legislature to set aside taxpayer money to private schools for special needs students, with the exception that state payments cannot exceed the costs of the attending child. Now, the bill is supported by the Michigan Catholic Conference, but opposed by much of the education community, the school administrators, the teachers' unions, the secondary school principals, among others. Democrats are opposing it. They are calling it a type of a voucher system brought up as an equalizer, as a means for parents to choose the schools that they want their child to attend. Adam Zemke, a Democrat from Ann Arbor, said, quote, "There is nothing equal about public tax dollars being given to private schools that can pick and choose who their students are. Unfortunately, this particular suggestion is cloaked in a veil of kindness with the claim that it would help special education students, so it looks innocuous. At the end of the day, however, it's still a ploy to weakened public schools." Now, the reason I mention this is because there are possibilities that we have no ballot proposals in front of voters in November. No statewide petitions, no proposal one or two or three or anything. And it would be the first time since the state began reviewing records back, or keeping these kind of records back in 1964, that we would not have some type of ballot question in a presidential ballot year since the new Constitution, 1964. We didn't have one in 1990, but at that time, that was a gubernatorial election. So we are entering some very interesting ground here. So I bring up this thing about private schools and whether special education money should go to private schools to help compensate for the teaching of the child, because there are a few other things that are out there as possibilities. We have the Marijuana Legalization Committee. What's going on with them? Well, we talked with the head of that operation, Jeffrey Hank. He's an attorney in East Lansing. And he said that it's going to be a burner there until the end. He's not tipping his hand as to whether they'll get enough of the signatures or not. Pretty much 50-50 is what it looks like there. So we've got marijuana legalization out there. We also have a coalition that looks to ban the practice of fracking in the state of Michigan. So we've got that out there. They think that they may be able to get the votes or the signatures needed to get on the ballot. That's still out there. And then we also have something called paid sick leave. This is a ballot proposal that's out there that deals with whether employers should be mandated to give their employees a certain amount of sick time. I believe it's an hour for every 40 hours work, something like that. I'd have to look it back up again. But essentially, the premise is that if you work a certain amount of time, regardless where you work, you get some earned sick time. That ballot proposal is also out in the field, but the prospects of it getting the signatures needed by the June 1 deadline, which is now less than 30 days away, are kind of dubious. So anyway, we're keeping our eyes on that and, you know, we'll see if anything makes the ballot. We do have an election today in parts of the state, bonding elections, school elections. There are some elections out in Kent County in Grand Rapids where we have a caller coming in, Mark from Grand Rapids. Good morning, Mark. Thanks for calling into the Steve Gruber Show.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm all in favor of public funds going to Catholic schools. The reason being, I attend a Catholic school. My kids all go to Catholic school. I never used public schools, and yet the lion's share of my property taxes go to fund public schools. So I'm already paying into the system, and I never use it. Also, the public schools are an abysmal failure in Grand Rapids for the most part, and Catholic schools are successful. So the argument that somehow the taxpayers, you know, being ripped off by funding Catholic schools is ridiculous.
Well, and here's another argument here too, Mark, is when you take a look at the Detroit public schools, and I know you're talking about Grand Rapids here, but one of the biggest costs for Detroit public schools is special needs kids, because the children who have special needs obviously do cost a bit more to educate. And charter schools, the argument goes that in some charter schools, they can pick and choose what kind of students they have come in, and they can say, no, or they may not have the accommodations to teach a special education student. Why don't I just put it that way? They're not necessarily equipped. And so the special education kids end up just going to public schools. Now, if money were given to private schools as an incentive to maybe have a program for special needs kids, maybe that would open up new doors and new possibilities to special needs kids. What do you think of that argument, Mark?
I think that's fine. I think, you know, obviously most people can't afford to send their kids to Catholic school, or if they had the option, they would, because they succeed. I mean, whatever works well for educating the kids, and I'm all for it, but the problem is with the public schools is they don't teach. You know, my daughter's daughter is a teacher. I've talked to other teachers, and there's no discipline in the classroom. The kids who are unruly, they don't get rid of, because then they lose funding. And so you have maybe 30% of the kids who are out of control in the classroom, which makes it almost impossible for the other 70% to have a chance to learn.
Well, thanks for joining us, sharing your opinion, Mark. Appreciate it. We got to hit a break here. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS Newsletter, filling in for Steve Gruber. We'll be back after this.
Taking a closer look at the stories that affect you most with a big dose of common sense.
I want to fly like an eagle to the sea. Fly like an eagle, let my spirit carry me. I want to fly.
You're listening to the Steve Gruber Show. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS Newsletter, filling in today. Thanks for joining us. Well, Americans who are struggling to pay their bills or to increase their standard of living would get a big lift if local governments around the country reduce the regulation of land use and strengthen individual property rights. That's according to Salim Firth. He's a research fellow in macroeconomics in the Center for Data Analysis of the Institute for Economic Freedom and Opportunity at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for joining us on the program today, sir.
Kyle, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Too many local governments have brought harmful ideas to the cities and suburbs. And what should they be doing here? I mean, should we be allowing local, or should we be allowing our residents and our businesses to do what they want here with their property?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. This isn't just a matter of economic freedom, although it is a matter of economic freedom. But it's about affordability, and in the long run, it's about economic growth. In some parts of the country, people are tending to move out, so you're not going to see really high prices in a rural area or cities like Detroit. But in places like San Jose and Boston, where wages are really high, a lot of people want to move there and take those jobs. But you can't, because the houses are full. There's a lot of demand for housing, and they won't expand the supply. The local governments say, no, we've got enough houses, don't build any more. So you'll see big cities. 1 month this year, New York City only permitted 25 new housing units.
In the whole city of New York?
I think it was in Manhattan, but that's a place with 2 million people, where 25 housing units probably, you know, fall apart every year or every month, easily. You're not even replacing what you're losing, you know, in you know, churn, if you're permitting so few new houses.
So, are these zoning laws then that local governments are using?
Yeah. So it's a combination. So the usual way it works is sort of this trap where the local government sets up a really strict zoning law that says, hey, you know, every project is going to get a variance. Unless you're just doing, you know, some, you know, redoing your bathroom or something trivial like that. You just come in, you get your variance from the zoning law, and that way we get to kind of check every project. So this is really normal. It's these very, very strict zoning laws where almost nothing qualifies, but you can get around it. But the problem is then the getting around it means you've got to get permission from all these people in the government, and in a lot of cases, all your neighbors. Your neighbors have to like the idea of what you're doing. And they say, is this going to increase my property values or decrease it? And that's you know, essentially an infringement on private property, and it also just creates gridlock because all the different parties have to agree.
That's called NIMBYism, isn't it?
That's right. Not in my backyard. And, you know, the corollary to NIMBY is banana. Build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone.
I've never heard that one before. I got to use this.
Yeah, and that's what happens in places, you know, especially the big coastal cities, where you've got the kind of left-wing mindset that, yeah, we should make all these decisions together and people shouldn't be, you know, on their own making a big decision like whether a house should be built on a parcel of land. That's, you know, that's a community decision. And the result is there's always somebody who says no and who puts their heels in the mud. And it's just very hard. And sometimes it just leads to delays, but delays dissuade developers from beginning projects. Because if you want to begin a project, you've got to lay down a lot of your money, buy the land, and then you've got to go see if you can get approval. And if there's a long delay, you don't even want to wait and find out because you're tying up your investment potentially for years just to find out whether you can be allowed to build or not.
But there should be some regulations, right? Or else we could get a farm in the middle of the city, or we could get a high rise in the middle of some rural township out in Timbuktu. I mean, there's got to be some type of management about what people build, shouldn't there?
There should be safety codes. You know, I think it's a clear role for government. I don't want every time I enter a business to say, well, let me pull up the blueprints for this building on my phone. I'm going to look at these blueprints and evaluate whether I think this is a safe building. I'm not qualified to do that, and I think it's great that we are able to trust, and I think we have fantastic, you know, building inspectors in the U.S. We see very, very low failure rates for buildings, and that's a good piece of regulation that should be kept. I don't think there's any risk of high-rises in little rural communities. If you built a high-rise, they're very expensive. To build up is very expensive, and there's not much demand when you could be building, you know, ranch houses for a fraction of the cost per residential square foot. If there's a farm in the city, I mean, you know, maybe that's weird, but who does it hurt, right? So you know, we have petting zoos in cities. We've got, you know, all sorts of interesting oddities. The whole point of a city is you kind of mash all these different things together and it becomes a very productive agglomeration economy. Farms usually need low land values to make the economics work. And in cities with high land values, that's not going to happen. So the market it'll do some things that some people don't like, right? So some people aren't going to like the traffic that's drawn to the new business that builds down the street from them. The question is, do we allow those people to overrule the owners of the property and then the market in general, which needs somewhere to put businesses, right? So banana, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone. If you follow banana, you get no jobs, no new housing for new residents to move in from elsewhere, no economic growth. Even the city of Detroit, which has lots of excess housing, is finding that it can benefit from less regulation because in transforming units from, you know, say a business that made sense 25 years ago, I don't know, the proverbial record store, to a business that makes sense now, stripping out some of the steps that you have to go through to just transform from one kind of business to another. And that's helping to revitalize some of these old urban neighborhoods, because who wants to spend their money and their time going through a regulatory process, people get into business to do business, to sell interesting things to consumers, to create jobs. They don't get into business so that they can, you know, make some bureaucrats happy by filling out forms in triplicate.
That's a good point. Salim Firth is with the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for joining us on the broadcast today.
Thanks, Kyle. You have a great day.
You're listening to The Steve Gruber Show. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in today. We've got a lot more coming up after this.
Genuine Michigan common sense on display every day.
Tell me lies. Tell me lies. Tell me sweet little lies.
You're listening to The Steve Gruber Show. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter. Hopefully we're not telling you any lies today. We only tell the truth on this show, by golly, at least when I'm hosting it. Well, we have heard quite often that conservatives are anti-science. And joining us on the other end of the line is somebody who's going to refute that claim. He's Seton Motley. He is the president of Less Government. Thanks for joining us on the show this morning.
Always a pleasure, man. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so why are conservatives not anti-science, and why is the Obama administration anti-science?
Well, the left in general, of course, is anti-science. An example I didn't even put in the piece was, when a human sperm meets a human egg, does it make a walrus? Does it make a porpoise? Does it make a fish?
Maybe
no,
on
it
some
makes
science.
A human being.
Maybe
the
some
moment
sci-fi.
The sperm meets the egg. To say anything else is anti-science. Mathematics. They don't like mathematics. It's pretty obvious that when you force the government forces private companies to pay a higher minimum wage, there's less money for people to be employed. Thus, the minimum wage is anti-math, but they insist on installing it. Heck, the governor of California said, this doesn't make economic sense, but we're doing it anyway. Oh, okay. Genius. But there's tons of examples, in the Obama administration especially. The left claims that the carbon dioxide is a pollutant, which of course it's not. Ask a plant. Don't hate, respirate is my approach to carbon dioxide. But if carbon dioxide contributes to global warming, why has India and China exponentially increased their carbon dioxide output, and yet the global temperature has flatlined since 1998?
The globe is warming, though. Would you concede that point or not?
Not since 98, no.
Not since 98. Now, you wouldn't say that the average temperature around the globe, if you look at this past year to last year, has not gone up?
Well, no, because most of the look, there's a lot of fraud going on in the collection of the data too.
Okay.
Remember, we've already caught, amongst other places, East Anglia University, which is the United Nations climate science go-to entity. We've caught the National Oceanographic Administration and NOAA, and we've caught NASA all fudging the numbers. So to take their numbers and say it's gone up from last year to this year is a little problematic, because they've been caught cheating.
Okay, how so, though? Because I'm taking a look at NASA's numbers right now, and there's a trend line that's going upwards.
If you look at the article, I don't remember off the top of my head, link to an article describing how NASA, NOAA, and of course, East Anglia was the most famous. That was the climate gate where the Russian hacker hacked into their email account and showed them not only fudging numbers, but refusing to peer review studies by anti-climate alarmists and that sort of thing. It's a whole academic assault against attempts to disprove this climate myth that's been going on.
Now, I'm taking a look at this article you're talking about. This is the American Spectator Climate Gate. This time it's NASA. That's the article I think you're talking about.
Right.
Okay.
But anyway, and then of course I shifted to, in the article, the Federal Communications Commission. There's a reason I focused on them. The reason being, the Federal Communications Commission, amongst all the executive branch agencies, is supposed to be an independent agency, free and devoid of the political noise and political influence, to issue regulations independently, with an expert look at the science and the technology of the fields they're regulating, so as to make the best most pro-science, most pro-technology determinations on how little or how often to regulate the sector. And under this, under the Obama administration, they've been about as anti-economic, anti-science, anti-technology as has ever been the case at the Federal Communications Commission.
So when you hear the left say that conservatives are anti-science, does that just kind of make your blood boil?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, they're the ones that are against genetically modified foods. Why? Because
what's going to happen to you if you eat them, right?
We live longer, like we have been for the lifespans have continued to increase as we've.
We're getting bigger. We're getting taller.
We're getting taller.
People, right?
We're living longer. We're all of these things. I'm 6'5". I guess GMOs are awful. But the point is, in the face of all, and by the way, going back to the global warming thing, they've been wrong for decades on their predictions. Before now, they've been wrong for decades and decades. So A, they've been wrong for decades. B, they fudge the numbers. B, they won't. C, they won't peer review anybody's study that might disprove their myth. At what point, there's way too much fraud and lying involved for it to be true, in my estimation.
Okay, now getting back to the GMIs here in food, now, doesn't it concern you at all that there's certain, that we're getting seeds that are being manipulated,
No.
In some, okay, why not?
Because why?
Okay, we're getting seeds that are being manipulated in some laboratory somewhere. I mean,
yeah.
We don't know what it's going to do to us.
Well, that's, I don't, what? So we have seedless grapes now. That's awful. What evidence is there that it's a bad thing? We understand the genetic code well enough to make seedless grapes and shorter wheat and all of these things. And as a result, people are living longer. We hear about obesity in Africa. Remember UNICEF and all that for all the starving Ethiopians and all that? Now we're reading about obesity in Africa. That's a pretty good human development, wouldn't you say?
So you're saying here, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, and you're doing a pretty good job. We're talking with Seton Motley, the president of Less Government here. I'm just playing devil's advocate that there is a fear in the unknown. I mean, what happens when you genetically mutate something that we put into our mouths and digest?
Right.
I mean, there's that. But could you also make the argument that we have been evolving over time, and just not people, but certain strands of, let's say, tomatoes or any other type of fruit or vegetable that maybe didn't even exist, 200, 300 years ago.
Well, I think isn't it like 5,000 species, like 1,000 species a day die? And
right.
Most of them are microorganisms and stuff. But look, the Earth is constantly changing. That's why this climate change moniker is such an absurd fallacy. The climate's always changing. The species live, species die, species we've never heard of. We discover new species all the time. We're deep sea fishing off the coast of Madagascar, and we pull up this fish, and we're like, "What the hell is that? We thought that was extinct 2 million years ago." It's an incredibly complex organism that we're learning tiny bits about, and the tiny bits we learn about, if we can improve them to the betterment of humanity, why shouldn't we?
And here's something I want to throw on the table. The Honeycrisp apple, the most tasty apple, I think, on the planet, that was basically created as well. I mean, that's not a natural thing.
I've never had a Honeycrisp,
so I cannot
speak to its tastiness.
Oh, see, you got to come up to Michigan. Honeycrisp apples are the greatest. They are.
I don't see them at Safeway down here, but maybe I should try to do some searching.
All right. Well, Seton Motley, he is president of Less Government. We've got to send you a Honeycrisp apple. These things are the greatest. They don't stay in season very long, and they don't hold in the grocery store. So when you get them, you got to snatch them up. You can charge up the wazoo for them, and people will buy them. We got to hit a break here. You're listening to the Steve Gruber Show. I'm Kyle Malin. We'll be back.
Delivering Michigan common sense with a big dose of truth and honesty.
Good morning. You're listening to the Steve Gruber Show. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter. Thanks for joining us today. Join us on the other end of the line for our final segment, Megan Barth. She is the founder of Reagan Baby www.thebrewerytoday.com. And we're talking about a true story of the cruel and unusual punishment of a brain-injured veteran. Megan, thanks for being on the program today.
Hey, Kyle. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for highlighting the story.
Well, please tell our listeners about Clayton Clay John App.
Yeah, Clay App is my cousin. He's a 33-year-old man, 7-year veteran of the Army, 2 tours of Iraq, came back after his second tour, a brain-damaged man diagnosed with PTSD and TBI. Before his second tour, he rose through the ranks of the Army quite quickly and was even offered honor guard on 3 separate occasions. He turned it down because he wanted to go airborne. After his second tour, he came back, like I said, injured. And like many vets who have trouble with their injuries, their mental injuries specifically, they wind up on the wrong side of the law. And that's what happened to Clayton. He was charged with a sale of $200 of drugs to a CI, which he faced prison time. So the DA offered him a deal as a CI. And if you read the story, he kind of was, in my opinion, pigeonholed and treated very unfairly by the DA and the county. The judge took mercy on him and gave him veterans court. And veterans court is a godsend for vets that are injured. And it was specifically designed for vets who fall into trouble. It takes them out of the criminal system and puts them into a therapeutic rehabilitative system that provides them with therapy and comprehensive therapy for them to cope with their injuries. PTSD and TBI is a very cruel animal, cruel injury, because you can't see the injury. It's a mental injury. We thought our prayers were answered November 19th when the judge gave Clay veterans court, but unfortunately it took the county 4.5 months to get his paperwork finished. And the day that he signed his paperwork with the county, they charged him with a violation of probation, and now he sits in general population of a Florida state prison.
Now, how did he violate his probation?
Well, that's the interesting thing. You can't be on probation in order to get into veterans court. So if he was on probation, why did they complete the paperwork?
Mm. Okay. Well, right? That's interesting, because if he violated, that would presume that he was on probation to begin with. I didn't think he was on probation if you're in veterans court.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
So they said he violated his probation because he failed a test. They peed dirty.
Right.
And, you know, Clayton did have a drug problem. He used marijuana. And Veterans Court would have gotten them clean and would have provided him the resources and the therapy for him to get off of marijuana.
Well, now, was the marijuana, and I'm just playing, I don't know his situation, mm-hmm. but was it of a medical type thing?
Because
some people need to use it to cope, right?
Right. And it's common. A lot of vets actually will use medical marijuana, especially with PTSD and TBI. I've done research.
Right.
But in Florida, it's not legal. There is no medical marijuana in Florida.
Oh, okay. We do have it up here in Michigan.
Right. And they have it in Colorado, and they have it in many, many states. So Clayton, you know, did understand that he had a drug problem and wanted to get off, but he couldn't handle the narcotics that the VA was giving him. And the narcotics that the VA were giving him were like Oxycontins, and he could not tolerate them. He said, Meg, if you would have told me someone shot my dog, I wouldn't have shed a tear. The narcotics made me numb, and I didn't like the numbness.
Isn't that something else, that Oxycontin is okay, but marijuana is not?
Yeah.
I mean, Oxycontin's some nasty stuff.
Well, exactly. And, you know, if Clay really was a criminal, he would have taken the Oxycontin. He had over 200 pills at one time of narcotics.
Wow.
He could have easily sold those on the black market. He didn't. He flushed them down the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
The VA hasn't paid him his disability benefits in 4 years due to a technical error. So the whole system really was set up against this kid. When he came back injured from the second tour of Iraq, there isn't a transitional resource for our vets who suffer from these mental injuries. They just are thrown back into civilization, thrown back on their parents' lap, really. And they have no resources outside of the VA. And we all know that the VA is a black hole of corruption and, quite frankly, incompetent abuse. So I have been on his case since August, and I am simply trying to get him into the medical ward, into the Florida State Prison, because that's the closest I could get to the treatment of veterans court. So this is just an ongoing saga. I wrote about it. It's on ReaganBaby.com. I've been talking about it. And I have also set up a fundraiser for Clay, which is within the piece, Justice for Clay, on GoFundMe.com. The county is now charging him $12,000 for his incarceration while he was in county jail. He has absolutely no means to pay for it because now the state suspended his license and won't give him his driver's license back until he pays the $12,000. Well, how is he supposed to get to work?
And this is all because he was dealing a little marijuana, because the marijuana was helping him cope with his traumatic brain injury.
Right. Well, when he was as a CI, he made a buy as a CI, and it was a small, like maybe an 8-ball of Coke or something, because that's what they wanted him to buy. Well, when he walked in the buy to the sheriff's office, they charged him with an unsanctioned buy and threw a 29-year sentence at him.
I gotcha. Well, we appreciate you sharing your story with us today. We got to hit a break. That's Megan Barth. You can read about it on ReaganBaby.com, like Ronald Reagan, ReaganBaby.com. We'll be back after this.